This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 347 was produced on October 27th, 2022. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Saxo Bank commodities guru Ola Hansen is back as this week's feature interview guest. Ola says that with structural inflation, commodity prices really can rise even in recession. We'll also talk about the energy crisis, base metals, precious metals, and much more. Nick Galarnik is off this week, so it'll be just Patrick and myself in the postgame segment.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Listeners, be sure to stay tuned to our postgame segment after Eric's feature interview with Ola Hansen, when Eric and I will discuss the S&P 500, the US dollar, and the first reactions to the euro from the ECB hikes. We'll also touch on crude oil, energy stocks, gold, copper, and the 10-year bond yield. Now, Eric, before we move on to the feature interview with Ola Hansen, let's cover crude oil, starting with that EIA inventory data.
EIA inventory reported a build of 2.6 million barrels, but what really happened was a drawdown of 0.8 million barrels plus a SPR draw of 3.4 million barrels. You add those together, it looks on paper like a 2.6 million barrel draw, but in reality, during restocking season, when we shouldn't be having drawdowns, we actually saw a 0.8 million barrel draw before that SPR provided the help. What happens when the SPR isn't there? We stop doing all of this monkey business. Cushing, Oklahoma, building 667,000 barrels, gasoline drawing down 1.5 million barrels, distillates building 170,000 barrels. Diesel inventories are a big deal. As we discussed last week, diesel fuel is what runs the commercial economy. All the trucks and construction equipment and so forth all runs on diesel fuel. We're down to 14.7 million barrels in inventory. For comparison's sake, in the same time of year in 2021, it was 38 million barrels, and it was more than 60 million barrels in 2020. But of course, there was an overstocking there as a result of the pandemic. U.S. production holding flat at 12 million barrels even. The United States exported 11.4 million barrels of petroleum products, about 5 million barrels of crude and 6.4 million barrels of finished products. So the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve, that's the emergency reserve we're supposed to keep set aside in case we needed it in case of war, for example, is supplying the entire world with oil that we cannot afford to spare, and we're actually exporting both crude oil and finished products as a result of all of these reckless drawdowns from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. On a closely related note, Saudi Arabia's energy minister made some very strong comments saying losing emergency stock may become painful in months to come. It's very clear to me what they're doing, which is to set the stage now so that later on, a few months down the road, when energy prices are going through the roof and Biden is complaining, saying it's all the Saudis' fault, they can say, no, actually, we warned you that your policies were going to cause this, and that's exactly what's happened. The tape action, normally you'd expect on a bearish inventory build that it would be down. It was actually straight up after inventory, and I think it was Saudi Arabia's comments and also the midterm election being almost here that have put a bid under markets. I think there's a lot of traders that are waiting to go long crude oil right after the midterm elections are over with. And of course, people are going to front run that and say, well, wait a minute, the oil that's going to be used to produce the gasoline from now to the midterms has already been consumed. Maybe now is the time. We don't have to wait. I think that's what you're seeing, and that's what's driving this move higher. There's also been some refinery disruptions this week, and that's resulted in a little bit of additional upside in RBOB gasoline. To my surprise, the United States beginning to stage the 101st Airborne Division. That's the first time since World War II that the U.S. Army's 101st Airborne has been stationed in Europe. The fact that they're staging those troops along the Ukrainian border, what they're saying so far is just practice drills. But, of course, it's pretty obvious they're getting ready for the possibility of the United States entering this war. Wait a minute. Didn't President Biden promise there was absolutely no condition under which U.S. troops would go into Ukraine? Well, they're not in Ukraine. They're in Romania, just a few hundred meters over the border, practicing. It seems to me like that ought to have put a bid under crude oil. It didn't, but Saudi Arabia's comments did. The next item this week is one that has a whole lot of people confused. So if you've heard that European natural gas prices went negative this week, you got a kind of a twisted story. It is true that the next hour spot price that's in the spot market, not the futures market, did go negative briefly. That has nothing to do with the long-term supply and demand outlook. It has everything to do with a cluster jam at some of the liquefied natural gas import and regasification terminals in Europe. And basically, the next hour spot price is just used to manage the flow of gas. They had a little bit too much gas coming in because a whole bunch of tankers are waiting to get into these terminals. And that, plus incredibly seasonably mild weather, has resulted in an anomaly where there's too much gas piled up that it can't get into some of these ports. Unseasonably mild weather has been an incredibly huge blessing for Europe, and it's resulted in this anomalous event. But winter ain't over until it's over, and it hasn't even started yet. I don't think February natural gas in Europe is going negative anytime soon. Ola Hansen will have much more to say in the feature interview.
Well, this week's feature interview guest is Saxo Bank's chief commodity strategist, Ola Hansen. Now, Eric, why did we invite Ola back on the show this week?
Well, Patrick, Ola Hansen is one of the most respected commodity strategists in the entire industry, but particularly a lot of commodities guys are really trend followers and they don't think in terms of a macro big picture view. This is Macro Voices. We want somebody who really has the command of macro and the deep understanding of commodities. And to my mind, Ola Hansen is the perfect man for the job. I think you're going to really enjoy this interview.
Well, Eric's interview with Ola Hansen is coming up as Macro Voices continues, right after this message from our sponsor.
If you invest to bring about a world powered by green energy, you should meet Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy that serves as a one-stop shop for green energy investors in Europe. Respect Energy brings together independent power producers, accredited and institutional investors holding assets in renewables or undertaking investments in new green energy production, such as wind and solar photovoltaic power plants. More than 600 institutional and accredited investors have already entrusted Respect Energy with the sale of their electricity production, portfolio management, O&M services, EPC, and project development. If you want to invest in green energy in Europe with the help of a trusted partner, contact Respect Energy today and ask for a tailor-made solution. For more information, visit respect.energy.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Ola Hansen, head of commodity strategy for Saxo Bank. Ola has prepared a terrific slide deck to accompany today's interview. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you're not registered. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, click the red button above Ola's picture that says looking for the downloads. Ola, it's great to have you back on the program. Let's go ahead and dive into the slide deck. As we get into page 3 here, you talk about commodities in general. Give me the big picture of where we are in the cycle, because my feeling has been the 2020s are going to be the decade you want to be long commodities. But I also felt like we kind of got ahead of ourselves a little bit in the recovery from COVID. I was thinking there's got to be a big pullback. I know a recession's coming. At some point, there's that buy the dip moment where if you could somehow magically have a crystal ball and know where that bottom point is, that's where you want to go long commodities and stay long for the next decade or so. At least that's been my view. Well, first question is, do you agree generally with that view? But the next one is, what's your crystal ball say? Are we there yet, or should we wait for a recession?
Well, I wish life was that easy, Eric, and thank you very much for having me back. It is a very interesting time in commodities, and you're absolutely right. We probably ran ahead of ourselves a bit, just not only from the COVID outbreaks, which just triggered this massive surge in demand for raw materials, but also the war breaking out in Ukraine, which added some additional rocket fuel to some of these individual markets. But we have been trading somewhat lower since then. We are stabilized. I would say at this point in time, but the longer term outlook, I think, is still one where we're looking at a scarcity of supply of several key commodities, where the upside potentials are still there. But it's also difficult for investors right now to navigate this market because we got quite a few contradictions going on right now. We have the dollar, which has been strengthening all year; it's creating some headwinds. We got demand, which is softened, especially in China, but where there's obviously worries about the recession incoming, the extent to which that will have an impact. And then we've got supply also of several key commodities being challenged. We obviously all know the situation right now in the gas market, especially in Europe, but also energy supplies in general and some of the metals. So whether timing-wise, I think everyone is right now looking for the rollover in the Federal Reserve's approach to interest rate hikes, and I think that will be a key moment for the commodity sector as well, because the market needs some more clarity on the trajectory of the dollar, and if we do see a rollover, that potentially could be quite an event that the market will respond to in a positive way when it comes to the commodity space. But I think what we're finding as well, and what has changed since the outbreak, and that's some of the themes that we're picking up here on page three, is basically that the world has changed. The world is, we're seeing breakdowns in trade relationships. We have a new geopolitical situation. And it basically means that some of the themes that we like from an equity investment perspective are also themes that really spills into the commodity space. We like to use equity themes as our guide to what moves markets here at Saxo Bank, and we made these different equity themes, and those are highlighted, are really the ones that we like. And we can also see they're the ones that has been on top in terms of performance so far to this year, which obviously has been a year with dismal performances across many different themes. But it is the commodity space, it is defense, it's nuclear power, it's renewable energy. It's probably India sitting nicely in between the East and West, and it's obviously cybersecurity. These are all the themes that we like. But our main thesis is basically that demand will potentially slow a bit, but supply will remain tight. Inflation is going to be higher than we anticipated in the past, simply because, and I'm referring also to some of the latest update that we had from Salton at Credit Suisse. Basically, he's using these reshoring and rewiring, the reshoring, deglobalization, rewiring of the grid, the energy transition. These are real, and these will be quite commodity intensive, and over the coming years. And we basically believe that will drive inflation to a higher level than where we have seen in the past. I think the underlying inflation in the U.S. for the past 20 years has been in the region of 2%. We could easily see that at least twice as high over the next decade, so 4+. And that is not something that's priced into the market at this point, and that could potentially create a revaluation of some of these markets if the market joins us in that belief.
Okay, this really brings an important question to my mind, because a few minutes ago, it sounded like you said, look for getting to that terminal rate on rate hikes. You know, when the Fed is done hiking and we've hit that maximum policy rate level before they start easing again, maybe that's the optimum time to really be backing the leverage truck up and stocking up on commodities or commodity producing equities, as the case may be. But I think we also agree that most people, including the Fed, are not being realistic about what I think is a secular inflation. So it seems to me you get to what everybody thinks is a terminal rate on policy, and then it turns out that the inflation doesn't go away, and maybe it doesn't end up really being the terminal rate after all. Am I right to think that, or how do you think about what may be coming?
That is the risk, basically, that the economic slowdown happens before they manage to get inflation under control, and also then the realization that the longer term projection for inflation has to be is going to end up at a higher level than what we have been used to in the past, and I mean, again, with a world which is so heavily indebted as it is right now, some inflation is would help bring down some of that those debt levels. So So I think at this point, they're sticking to their beliefs in inflation coming back down to those levels. But I think it will turn out to be more sticky than we expect. And then obviously they have to make a decision about where the terminal rate has to be in if we are entering into a high inflation and in high inflation environment. But that's also an environment where I think tangible assets will likely to continue to be in demand. Investments in general into tangible investments compared with the intangibles that has been the main driver of stock markets for the past decade.
Ole, moving on to page 4, you've got what looks like just a wonderful shopping list for our listeners of stocks that are producers of all of these commodities. But I want to clarify the meaning of this. You know, sometimes when a bank produces a list, it's their picks. This is what we think are the best investments. Other times, they're just giving you a list of these are the representative companies that make up the sector, and it doesn't really reflect any endorsement or belief on the publisher's part that particular stock is a good one. What is this list? Is this your list of favorites, or is this just the market?
It is the market primarily, and again, there's obviously some smaller companies where you can get a lot more bang for your buck. But these are the big companies represented within the different sectors of agricultural, energy, and metals. So it's primarily based on size and its global reach and its availability from a trading perspective. So this is basically the basket that has created that year-to-date 14% return that we showed on the previous slide. So these are the ones that we primarily focus on when it comes to that. There are obviously, as I said, individual companies outside of this list, which potentially could be even more interesting. But it's we first and foremost looked at having a decent spread across the different sectors, and then looking at then from top down, looking at from the biggest companies and downwards.
Let's move on to page 5 and a subject that's near and dear to my heart, lack of investment, particularly in the energy industry, and I would say a misplaced ESG agenda. Certainly, I'm for being responsible and being green, but I think the way that we've gone about it hasn't worked very well. Tell us a little bit more about what you see and what we should make of the graph here on page 5.
Well, it's just a little bit of an addition to what we have always already talked about. Basically, what drives a commodity supercycle, which really started to become something that was talked about almost 2 years ago. It's paused now, but the fundamental and underlying reason for believing in a commodity supercycle is, I think, has not gone away. And I think the main driver there is the lack of investments. We got the big oil companies reporting this week. Obviously, interesting to see how they're going to spend their hard-earned cash, which obviously will be at a very high level. But we are seeing a market of companies just simply struggling with this transition and the speed of it, or the timing of when we're going to see the big switch. And I can understand a big oil major looking at an investment that potentially could take 5 years before they start to make their money back, and then they have to make their money back over the next 5 to 15 year period. And we simply don't know what the demand outlook will be, what looks like for fossil fuels in 10 years time. So, and that's really the challenge that they're facing. And ESG has obviously been a major obstacle as well, with a lack of investments, lack of funds being made available for projects both within the energy and the mining sector. So that remains a key part of the super cycle. And then I think also the one that hasn't played ball this year, and that's the weaker dollar, which obviously has strengthened. And I think even considering that, is still quite a phenomenal performance we've seen already this year, in a year where the dollar is up as much as it is.
And what's your outlook for the dollar? Some people are saying, look, there's got to be some kind of Plaza Accord or something. We can't dare to let it go higher. Other people are saying, we're just getting started here.
Well, it's helping the process of killing growth, because it's just making everything punitively expensive for everyone who's not based in the U.S. So in that sense, it has speed up the slowdown in the economy, which obviously is what the central banks are looking for right now, because that is the instrument they have available: kill growth by hiking rates, and then supported by a strong dollar at the same time. But If we get to the point of a rollover in yields, I would expect the dollars to at least pause or hold, and eventually start to make a turnaround. The focus there will be on the Chinese renminbi, which has weakened quite substantially, and especially the Japanese yen, where there's just simply no the only buyer right now seems to be the Bank of Japan, and that will change when we see that turn, because then we have more clarity on the interest rate differentials in the markets. So we'll keep an eye on the yen, we'll keep an eye on the renminbi. Interestingly enough, we actually now seen net buying in the euro dollar for the past 2 months, even after we broke below $1, broke below parity. If you look at the speculative data that I collect on a weekly basis from the CFTC, we've seen the length in the euro actually going from a quite substantial short to a decent long right now. So it could indicate that there are starting to be some underlying demand or speculation that we're getting close to a through in the euro dollar at least.
Ola, let's move on to page 7 and 8, because as a commodity trader myself, I'm extremely interested in backwardation and contango, and particularly whether it jibes with the rest of my economic outlook. Let's start, for just some of our listeners who may not be commodity traders, with a quick review of what backwardation and contango, what those terms mean, but particularly what we're seeing in the current market.
Well, the backwardation and contango is simply the shape of the futures curve, because it tells us a story about whether the market is in tight supply or oversupplied. Right now, we're seeing backwardation across most major commodity futures, and that basically telling us that it's basically showing that the front month contract is the highest priced on the curve, basically indicating that the buyers of commodities, they are prepared to pay a premium for immediate delivery, and that does send the signal that this market is not in ample supply. That's the opposite of what we've seen for a number of years, where the market was actually in contango. That you can see here on the left-hand side. That's basically the weighted average of the Bloomberg Commodity Index. That's 23 commodities in total. The weighted one-year implied roll yield. So basically, if you bought those 23 commodities and held them for a year on the weighted basis according to the index, you would have been between 2006, as far as back this one goes, and then more or less all the way up to 2020, you would have had a negative roll yield. Basically, every month when the underlying futures were rolled, you were losing out because you were selling cheap to buy the next one at a higher price. That's what contango does to you. Right now, it's the complete reverse. And that's really kicked off when we saw the recovery during the pandemic in 2020. And this snapshot is just a couple of days old. It just shows you where we got the biggest backwardation right now. And just look at something like heating oil in the U.S. and also gas oil in Europe and RBOB gasoline in the U.S. If you are holding that, if you're buying that contract and expecting it to be unchanged, price unchanged in a year's time, you would pick up more than 25% roll yield on heating oil, and you can see 15, more than 15, more than 20 on the two others. That is a very, very forceful driver for investment demand, because that's basically giving you a positive carrier on a position. And this obviously has to be said. You talked about recession, Eric, and this is the reflection of mostly of the spot market demand, supply and demand right now. But it still indicates that the market is not in any hurry to price in a recession at this point. And just on the impact from an investment perspective, just take a look at the slide 8. I put in the biggest ETF tracking the Bloomberg Commodity Index, I believe it's called IPATH, Bloomberg Commodity, and the Bloomberg Commodity Spot Index. The spot index, basically the orange line, is just basically tracking the front month contract. And if you look at over the last 5 years' performance, the spot index indicated that you would have made a 55% return during that five-year period. But if you actually look at the ETF, you only made 39%. That is because throughout most of that period, you have had a negative roll yield, which has to be reflected in the lower performance of the ETF. If you just fast forward and just take a look at the last year, you can see how it's flipped around. Now, during this last year, the ETF has given you a return of 6.6%, while the actual spot index indicate that your performance should have been flat. And that's what backwardation does to your return. And that's something that, from an investment perspective, you have to keep in mind. So if you're going in, if we're staying within a prolonged period of market tightness and the general belief that commodity prices are just trading flat to potentially higher, then there will be a roll yield or return to be harvested from being long ETFs in commodities.
I'm particularly fascinated by this connection between backwardation versus contango and a recession outlook, because a lot of people hold the view, as you just alluded a moment ago, that when you see a market that is in backwardation, which is what we have now, that's an indication that we're not headed in toward any kind of recession because markets are in tight supply and it doesn't make sense for that to occur in recession. But I think there's also another side to that, which is you could spin it another way and say what the backwardation is telling you is that we're not headed for deflation. And if you look at that view, then you say, oh, wait a minute, maybe what it means is if we're going to have a recession, which I think we are, it doesn't mean the inflation is going away, because it may be that the resurgence of secular inflation is actually a cause of the recession, and it may be that the inflation persists even during the recession. Is that just wishful thinking? Am I trying to persuade myself to believe in my own outlook, or does that make sense?
No, I think you're absolutely right, Eric. And that's also, it basically is one of the theses that we are putting out right now, that we can have a recession and high commodity price at the same time. Because one thing is whether, and I would say almost at this point in time, you would almost need a slowdown in demand for some of these commodities just in order to make sure they don't rally even further. I think the energy is a clear example of that. Because simply the supply side is challenged, equally challenged across some of these markets as well. So yes, the input cost from commodities can remain elevated and potentially even move higher, even though we have a recession, because the inflation that we had is also making production costs and so on has increased the cost of production. So that has to be factored into commodity prices as well in order to make it viable. So I agree with your view that recession is not necessarily one that means lower commodity price, because the supply side is equally important.
Well, that brings me back to my earlier question, which is I've been thinking that the time to invest in the commodity market for the long term, if you wanted to put on that trade that you're going to hold for 10 years and just be long a basket of commodities, because I think the 2020s are going to be a commodity decade. I was previously thinking, wait for the recession so that commodities bottom. But I think we just agreed that it's actually commodities not bottoming that could be the cause of the recession. So does that mean right now is the time to put on that trade? Do you wait for something? How do you time this?
Well, I think we're only months away from some major development in China in terms of adding stimulus into the economy to support a recovery from these pandemic lockdowns, which clearly has not worked very well. So China coming back together with the potential through in the yields, and with that a weaker dollar, I mean that is really a potent cocktail for commodities in terms of sending prices higher. So I think we are with within a short period of potentially hitting a low, if we haven't hit it already, because again the market is responding to what we know, and everyone is screaming recession. And you would have imagined, given the fact that as well that there are traders in these commodity markets who are using a macroeconomic overlay for making their investment decisions and trading decisions, and that's been part of the selling that we've seen in recent months. So some of that recession has been priced in, I would say, almost at these levels. And the market has been holding up remarkably well, I would say, especially the energy, where there's been constant talks about a near-term collapse, and I just don't see that coming.
Let's move on to page 9 now for commodity futures traders like myself. The Commitment of Traders report is kind of the holy grail of weekly data. Tell us what it is for some of our listeners who aren't familiar with it.
Well, basically, just considering the futures market as a big pie, because it's a closed circle. So you have, for each long, you have a short that basically adds up to a total number of long and short. That is the open interest. That open interest can be broken into specific user groups, which is handled by the CFTC in the U.S. When it comes to commodities, as you can see, the breakdown of the open interest is put into four major categories: producers, merchants, processors, swap dealers, managed money, and then the bucket which contains the rest, which is called others. And that's why the commodity space especially, I think, is interesting, because most of the trading activity always ends up in the futures market in some way or another. And that basically means if you look at the managed money category especially, that's the one I follow primarily. And I used to work for a hedge fund myself back in my days in London, and we were behaving in very much in the sense that many of these money managers do behave, because what are they? Well, they're not married to the position first and foremost. They're not as we mere mortals sometimes get into the situation where we believe we are right and the market is wrong. And the hedge funds, they always listen to the market, so they have tight stops and no underlying exposure most of the time. That basically means they are reactive to changes, or they're very reactive to changes in the fundamental or the technical price developments. And that basically gives us a good idea about not only the major trends, so the size of the position relatively to the historic norms, but also what kind of impact the potential reversal in the market could have on the price action, especially when we've seen that quite often when we have very elevated positions and suddenly the tide turns for whatever reason, then we know there is a potential quite strong counter reaction from funds simply having to reduce their positions. And what I want to show on this is really that the market is completely unprepared for, or the managed money right now is completely unprepared for any further increase in the price. That obviously does go hand in hand with the technical picture, which is not really sending any strong signals right now. So that's probably one of the reasons why we see such relatively low positioning, even though we have commodities, some commodities still at quite elevated levels. But it also highlights the fact that if we do see breakouts, or we see some renewed demand come into individual commodities, and we see some technical developments, then we will also see these funds reverse back into the market, and that will provide some additional tailwind. I just put in the table on slide 10. It's a lot of numbers, but it's just my weekly. That's basically my radar. I publish that weekly, both on Twitter and in our update, which can be found on analysis.sax. So this is basically my radar, where I just keep an eye on the changes and then keep an eye on the size of the positions, whether we're getting into overbought or oversold or overextended or underappreciated markets. And thereby, that basically means when we get to those, are keep a close eye on when we have any change in the direction. And a good example was gold, where we just recently had, I think just 2 weeks ago, we had the biggest short in 4 years. We got rejected at 1617, the key level, which we'll show later. And then the market rallied almost $100. That rally was primarily short covering, because we went from the biggest short in 4 years to a small long. And it also reflects why the market didn't continue, because the news, underlying news, were not strong enough to support a recovery from that point. So the initial move was one of short covering, and since then we've been drifting lower again. So it's just my radar for how the professionals they view the price action in the different markets.
I just want to add my own endorsement, Ola, which is if you try to process the government published commitment of traders data yourself, it's incredibly arcane and difficult to follow. Your graphs and charts are absolutely fantastic, and they're free of charge. So if you don't want to look at the government's version, you want to look at the same charts and graphs that we're looking at here on pages 9 and 10, and you can get those on a continuing basis. We'll tell you at the end of this interview exactly where to go to find that. Let's move on to energy now. Before we get into slide 11, where you're talking about OPEC cuts, I want to just start with the big picture. And by all means, please speak up if you disagree with me. But a lot of guests have agreed with the view that I have, which is we've reached a point where I'm convinced it is not possible for the economy to return to pre-pandemic normal, so to speak, because we simply no longer have sufficient supply of oil and gas in order to support that. And yeah, we're going to get to an electrified economy and green energy and everything someday, but we're not there yet. And the world runs on oil and gas, and we don't have enough of it. And furthermore, I've made the argument that it's not a problem that you can change by just changing policy and pushing a button. It takes several years of investment in order to fix this problem. I think that means that we are at the very early stages of a global energy crisis. And I think that a lot of the difficulty Europe has experienced already is coming to the rest of the world. Do you agree or disagree with that view, and why?
I do agree. the strength of the move higher is obviously up for discussion, but the underlying reasons for the tightness that we're seeing right now is not only caused by the West cutting off Russia as a meaningful source of supply, at least for now. It is the lack of investment, and that is driven by, as we talked about, the uncertainty regarding the long-term demand outlook for fossil fuels, and it's creating potentially at least a 5-year period where we could see prices just remaining elevated, and that's even if we see a slowdown in economic growth, because we still need to the underlying demand is not going to be that significantly impacted. You see, yes, the pandemic was a massive blow, but that was just the whole world shut down from one day to the next. But if you look at the previous recessions, the drop in demand has not been that great. And I think what is interesting right now, even though we have all these projections for lower growth next year, we still have not seen any. I still haven't seen anyone actually predicting a drop in demand next year. I'm still seeing demand growth coming in next year. They have been moderated in recent months. I'm obviously thinking here about OPEC, IEA, and EIA, their monthly reports. But even some of the banks have yet to change their outlook towards a contraction in demand. And then that basically brings us to the point, well, this market is not a status quo market. We need to find 5 to 8 million barrels on an annual basis just to maintain status quo. And it's the investment required to find those 5 to 8 million barrels at a time where big producers like Saudi Arabia is getting close to their capacity. That is the big challenge that we're facing. And that just requires a lot of money and a lot of investment. And this is the challenge that we're facing. And adding to this in the short term, and that's why I put in these OPEC plus cuts. We just have to understand the crude oil is not crude oil. Crude oil is different qualities, and also where we have the tightness right now. The tightness is found in the distillate market. It's diesel. It's heating oil. It's jet fuel. And we can see that on the crack spreads, both in New York and in Europe. These are the red lines on the right-hand side on slide 11. We have very elevated crack spreads right now. So refineries are making a decent amount of money on their refinery. And that's simply because the demand is strong and inventories are low. And then into that, OPEC Plus decides to cut production by 2 million barrels. That effectively will probably be around 1.1, 1.2 million. But who can make those cuts? It's really only Saudi Arabia, UAE, Kuwait, and a couple of others. And the problem with that is that these three major Middle East producers, they produce this high-yielding distillate barrels. So the heavier grade, which is perfect for producing diesel, among others. We have enough gasoline right now. It's diesel that we're missing. So basically, they're removing 1.1, 1.2 million of high-yielding distillate barrels, and then we have to be replaced by potential lower-yielding crude from other sources. And I think that is another key that don't look so much at the oil price, but look at the price of the underlyings, and then they remain elevated. In Denmark right now, diesel is more expensive than gasoline. That's only the second time it's happened in the last 20 years, and I think that goes the same scenarios unfolding elsewhere. And diesel is really the workhorse that's required to keep the wheels running at a time where obviously gas prices are as high as they are. So if you have a generator standing at the back of your yard or your factory, you'll obviously burn as much diesel as you can, because it's even at these levels is historically cheap relative to gas.
And for the benefit of Americans in the audience, when you say relative to gas, you're speaking relative to natural gas, since Europeans refer to gasoline as petrol, whereas
exactly.
many Americans
exactly.
think of gas as meaning gasoline. Speaking of natural gas, Ola, help me out here. Just a few weeks ago, it was unanimous agreement among all of the experts that I interviewed on this program, all of the analysts that I follow. Everybody said the same thing, which is, look, if they don't turn Nord Stream back on, Europe is in big trouble. Everybody's going to freeze before the winter is over. It is, you know, the sky is crashing. The world's coming to an end. We got to do something to get Nord Stream back on. And then when the Nord Stream pipeline was sabotaged, the doomsday bloggers took over and said, okay, this is it. Armageddon is here. Half of Europe's going to freeze to death. Somehow this week, that has shifted to actual serious discussions of the possibility of negative natural gas prices in Europe because of a supply glut. There's suddenly too much. What the heck happened?
Well, what happened was that we all put on a jumper and turned down the heating, and then we've been also had the fortune to be supported by mild autumn weather. I think just like you're seeing in the US right now, that weather has been at least for the next few weeks, we're going to see weather in Europe temperature be in the region of 4 to 8 degrees higher than what we have normally have this time of year in late October, early November. That is that's having quite a significant impact on demand. But at the same time, collectively across Europe, private individuals are discussions at the dinner table has gone from how fantastic the property market's been doing for the last 10 years to how on earth can we save on our gas bills, because they have really become punitively expensive. So, and there's been a lot of waste as well. Industry has been used to cheap gas for a long period of time, so it wasn't really where they put in their efforts to preserve or to cut back. They're doing that now, and that's collectively happening across Europe. So it basically means that demand for gas, natural gas, has come down quite significantly already. I think in the region of the estimates I'm seeing in the region of 15 to 17%. At the same time, if you look at the pickup we've seen from LNG flows into Europe and also increased flow from Norway, the net flow into Europe, including Russia, is only down around 12% year on year. So right now the flow is down by less than demand has gone down. And that basically means inventory levels has managed to build very, very strongly, just like we're seeing in the US right now. So we're getting pretty close to tank tops. And that led to the situation where we saw just yesterday or this week that briefly we saw the next hour cost of gas going negative. So we had a bit of a WTI moment in the European gas market. We'll continue to see the first month, which the spot months, be quite volatile and potentially trade even lower than the 100 euros that we are seeing right now, simply because if the mild winter continues and we've got LNG ships lined up to deliver their cargoes, then that will keep the price under pressure. In order for this two things. First of all, we will not see a WTI moment as such in Europe, because obviously this flow all depends on gas, natural gas coming in from via LNG, and these LNG ships, they can obviously divert their course and go somewhere else to offload their natural gas if the price becomes economically unattractive. So we're not going to see the price complete utter collapse, and that's also important for this to be maintained, to become hopefully a success story into next year, that we do still need higher prices, basically simply to make sure that demand is not that we become a bit less fair again and we start to go back to our old habits. So what I'm looking at right now is really the spread between the current spot month and the peak winter contract of February, which is currently trading around 45 euros. So basically meaning that the peak February contract is still trading above 140 euros. If we look at the next winter, it's still trading above 130 euros. These are really the ones that we need to see come down in order to start to get to be a bit more relaxed about the longer term outlook. But obviously, every day that we have this warm weather in Europe, the potential for us leaving this coming winter with a higher level of inventory that we otherwise would have thought is obviously rising, and that will make the next refilling season a little bit easier to get through.
I got an email from our mutual friend Tracy Schuchart, a well-known oil trader, who asked me specifically to get your outlook for 2023 natural gas. I think her view is, look, everybody is mesmerized by what's just happened. She said, look, we got a gift here of nice weather. It's not going to last. It doesn't mean the problem is over. The problem is very real. We just got very lucky with autumn weather that's not going to last. Do you share that view, or is the problem really and truly getting better?
Well, I think in order to get lucky, we need to see gas prices, natural gas prices, drop well below 100, because we have to remember the long-term average is less than 20. So, in order for it really to have an impact on the cost of energy in Europe, we need to see it much lower. But from the position that we traded 200 plus or even 300 just a few months ago, then just the fact that if we can settle in to a price around the 100 euro level, then that itself, I think, will be a relief to many industries. Because one thing is the price that they're paying. The another thing is the uncertainty about where prices are heading. And I think with Russia's ability to spook the market sharply reduced, we really only have two pipelines left, one going through Ukraine and one going through Turkey. So the Turkey one they will not touch because that's going to Russia-friendly consumers primarily. And the one through Ukraine, I think most forecasts are basically expecting that one to be closed down as well. And that potentially it's not going to have a significant impact on the market because of the current flows from LNG. But the two biggest challenges are first of all obviously the weather. Whether we hit a very cold winter, so far no signs of that, but who knows? January, February is normally the time of year where that happens. And then also if we do see a revival in China, leading to a bigger demand for gas, because gas demand from China has been weak in recent months. I think we even seen gas supplies, gas going to China being diverted to Europe because the price were better here. That could obviously reverse, and that would make it the filling process a bit more challenging. But in terms of prices, I think we'll see prices into next year stabilize around the 100 euro level. The winter next year is as I said 130 plus, but that one will come down if we get through the exit this winter with a higher level of inventory that we forecast. And I think the chance of that happening, given what we're seeing right now, is rising.
Let's move on to copper on page 13, obviously a very important commodity. What do you make of this? And particularly something I've been thinking about is it seems to me like the energy crisis that I think is coming is going to put a real dent in the ESG movement. I don't think it's going away. I very much think that we need to invest in electric vehicles and electrifying the economy and so forth. But feels to me like maybe the copper boom that people expected because of electric vehicles maybe is on hold for a few years. What do you think?
Well, I think it's on hold, but at the same time, I think it's only just started. So the copper has been, just like I would say cotton and crude oil, to a certain extent been used as a macroeconomic hedge against an economic slowdown. It's also been used as a hedge against what's happening in China. But it looks like so far this year, the demand increase for copper towards renewables and for the transition has almost offset the slowdown from the property sector. And I think we only just have to look at the imports on the bottom right there, just showing that copper ore and copper on-road copper there, that we're still seeing year-on-year gains in imports. So even though we've had this property crisis in China, the demand has remained firm. Inventory levels has picked up in over the past couple of months, but they're still historically very low, and that basically means where's the copper going to come from if we do see a pickup in demand, especially from China over the coming months. So the negative story, I think, in copper is based on the fact that we know that there will be additional mine supply coming online next year. So the forecast I'm hearing is lower price next year, and then it's going to go higher the following years. I'm a little bit doubtful the market works that way in terms of the price action. And I think at the same time, we've seen Chile, one of the world's biggest producer of copper, having production problems in recent months, lack of water, ore grades starting to diminish. So more material has to be pulled out of the ground to get the copper that's required. And that obviously requires a lot of additional investment and capacity and energy and so on to do. So I think the copper is not only a story about demand, I think, being structurally strong over the coming years. It's also supply, which are following this next year's bump up, is likely to taper off and prevent or basically create a market where there's a strong foundation for a recovery in the price. But looking at where we are right now, we are settling in around that 350 level. Looking at high grade copper, it's more or less the halfway mark between the low in 2020 and the high this year. And I think it's also pretty clear that for some of the major big investors to change their view on copper, we need to go back above that $4 level. So that's the big line in the sand for potential bears to turn back to a more bullish case. But I maintain I'm bullish on copper. I'm bullish on the mining sector, and just look at all the different you need copper across all the different green initiatives, from batteries to the motors to the solar to the wind turbines and the hydrogen economy. So the demand from those sectors will continue to remain firm over the coming years. So I think we're still just at the beginning of the bull run. It was probably we had a bit of a false start in 2021. Since then we come down quite a bit, and actually correcting from a technical perspective at the perfect place, this 314, as you can see, it basically shows us we had a deep correction, but the uptrend is still more or less intact.
Moving on to page 14, gold is a market that I want so badly to believe in, Ole. I'm still long. I haven't liquidated any of my long position. But boy, a lot of the things that we've been taught that gold is supposed to do, it just hasn't been doing in this cycle. I mean, it's supposed to be a geopolitical hedge. And on the day that there were missiles flying and 20 major cities in Ukraine under attack, $20 down on gold on the day. What's going on here, and why is it that gold doesn't seem to be performing the way so many people thought it would?
Well, I think it really depends on, first of all, where you're sitting in the world. And I fully appreciate it. if you're priced based in dollars or Canadian dollars, you are not particularly happy with the return that you've seen, especially in dollars, obviously, this year, where we're down close to 10%. But let's start with first from a relative perspective. If you started the year by selling out of your iShares and your S&P and instead bought gold, you obviously would have done quite a significantly better than the products that you sold. So that's one thing. But same time, I think we simply just, gold is such a part of the established financial system in terms of algorithms driving a lot of trading activity. Algorithms, they look for correlations on a constant basis. And this year, obviously, two major themes has played out very significantly, and both very, very counter, very non-gold friendly. And that has been the strong surge we've seen in the dollar, and it's been the phenomenal rally we've seen in bond yields. These have really been major headwinds. And I think based on the length that we've seen gold or the dollar travel and the yields rise, I think gold has actually been doing significantly better than it has been, because we can see that on the next slide where we go to in a second. And it's holding this line in sand, which I'm calling that 16-17 level. It's maybe not out of the woods yet. For that, we need to see through in the Fed's view on peak rates. But I think we're getting close to that. And then the main thesis I'm looking at, and that's on slide 15, basically simply the fact that gold is still an insurance policy. So far this year, that has cost you in dollars a premium of 9% to have that insurance. In other currencies, you actually made money to have the insurance because of the dollar strength and weak currencies elsewhere. But what I'm looking for, and that's also the reason why this argument that, well, real yields are pointing to basically telling us that gold should be $300 weaker. Well, yes, that's true, but then gold should be $300 weaker already, because this is all known knowns. What we don't know, and that's really where our view on inflation comes in, that this market is not pricing inflation correctly. If our belief that the long-term inflation is going to be more anchored around the 4-5% area instead of the 2.5, which the 10-year break-even is right now indicating, then we will have a major realignment of expectations of prices sometime in, I would say, not too distant future, which would drive real yields down, i.e. up on the right-hand side where it's inverted, and break-evens obviously move higher at the same time. So we're using gold as insurance against the market being wrong in their belief that central banks will be successful in getting inflation down to levels where they're currently looking for it to go. And then obviously the geopolitical situation is also potentially one of the reasons why we have this wide gap between where gold is and where real yields are, because the world is a troubled place right now, and that's not showing any signs of improving anytime soon.
On your final slide, page 16, you've talked about agriculture sector being troubled by weather and war. When I interviewed Lee Gehring on this program, he said we're at the beginning of a major food crisis for the simple reason that the growth patterns, because emerging markets basically can afford to eat meat now, it's changed the trajectory of grain demand in a way that he thinks it just creates a massive, massive food shortage in coming years. Do you agree with that view, and what do you see on the horizon for agriculture?
Well, let's first of all let me say that I certainly don't hope so. But one thing is hope, another thing is what happens. And just looking at how the market has been behaving the last few years, we can see our ability to withstand a troubled growing season has become increasingly challenged. We've seen stock levels being brought down of some of the major and key crops around the world through the weather phenomena that we've seen now for basically 3 years running, with the La Nina having a profound impact on weather across the world, and that is likely to continue to play its part. But you're right, the need to continue to increase production is there, because our eating habits has become more crop intensive because of the, as you say, the meat consumption as well. But at the same time, also the geopolitical situation. If you look at something like wheat, where again, oil is not oil, wheat is not wheat. There's a difference between Chicago wheat that we trade and the wheat coming out of the Black Sea area. One goes into the animals, the other one goes into the bread production that feeds the global population. And we got a high protein wheat, not shortage, but at least very low level of supply. And with the developments in Ukraine and Russia not showing any signs of improving anytime soon, then that tightness will continue. In addition, the gas prices has led to the high cost of diesel to farmers, and not least the very high cost of gas, which has seen a dramatic increase in the cost of fertilizer. Potentially not a problem for the wealthy countries, but for the poor nations which you don't talk about, where fertilizer basically being used to make sure that there's enough food to go around to feed the family for the coming season. These are potentially where we could see additional problems, because the high cost of fertilizer basically means that some of that production may not live up to what is required, and that basically means we could see some countries being forced to enter the global the market for additional supplies, and that will continue to add some nervousness to the market. So I do worry that we could see higher prices over the coming years, and then the continued biofuel production as well is also taking both soybean and corn away from the food chain.
Ole, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview, but before I let you go, I really want to focus on page 17, because frankly, you give away more excellent quality stuff for free than just about anybody else I know. So I've lost track of it all between the daily podcast, the Commitment of Traders analysis that you do every week. Give us the rundown of what people can find at analysis.saxo.
Well, thank you very much, Eric. Well, analysis.saxo is basically where we post all our updates, and as you say, they are free. We have a global reach of, well, as I said, nearly 800,000 clients globally, which we supply information to, but we also make it available to everyone who's interested. If I should just point to a couple, we do a daily quick take, which for European based clients are published around 10 a.m. or 9 a.m. in the morning. It's just a rundown of what we are looking at in the day and what we think potentially could move the markets. The podcast has increasingly grown in popularity, obviously not to the extent of yours, Eric, but the fact that it's coming out on a daily basis is something that we've seen a great response to. We're not here to sell any particular product, so if there's something we don't like, we will say we don't like it. So that I think our listeners like that way of reporting the markets. And then obviously I do my flagship weekly commodity update on Fridays, where I just go through the major markets and what's moving and what to look out for in the week ahead. And then obviously if you want to join my little family on Twitter, you're more than welcome to do that. My Twitter handle is in the headline.
We look forward to getting you back on the show for an update in a few months. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this. After being completely sold out of advertising space for the last couple of years, we finally have capacity to add a new advertiser. Macro Voices has a Podtrac certified global audience of over 170,000 listeners, and each weekly episode typically gets 60,000 to 80,000 downloads. We have more than 20,000 accredited investors who have registered with us as accredited, and we estimate the total accredited investor audience as at least 40,000 accredited listeners, which we believe to be the highest number of accredited investor listeners of any podcast on the internet. We strive to accept tasteful advertising from advertisers whose product is likely to appeal to our audience. So we're looking for another investment or financial services advertiser to fill the space I'm speaking in right now. If your company wants to advertise on Macro Voices, please email sponsorship@macrovoices.com for more information. Now let's get right back to the show.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Eric, it was great to have Ole back on the show. I always love to get the commodity updates, but what resonated with me in this interview was him touching on those commitment of trader reports. It really is interesting to see how the dynamics have shifted. Nonetheless, what did you take away from the interview?
Well, Patrick, I really enjoy talking to Ola. He's one of the smartest guys that I know, and I was particularly fascinated by his comments about how it is entirely possible that we could see, despite recession, that commodity prices rise anyway as a result of secular inflation. And it addresses a question that's been burning in the back of my mind, which is, ever since the big rally, I think it was almost a year ago, our long-term listeners probably remember me saying on Macro Voices, okay, look, this copper rally has probably gone too far too fast and it's overdue for a pullback. But at some point, if you can catch that next bottom, I think the next several years for commodities and particularly for copper, with everything going on around electrification of the global economy and electric vehicles and so forth, infrastructure projects that are being contemplated, there's just so many good reasons for copper's rally to continue. I was thinking the time to load up on copper was just as the recession gets into its depths and we're really in economic trouble. This made me realize, wait a minute, maybe trying to time the market that way is not such a good idea, particularly if you look at that copper chart in Ola's deck. If that breaks through the symmetrical triangle that he has on that chart, and particularly if it goes over $4, it really makes you scratch your head and say, wait a minute, maybe I already missed the low and I'm late to the trade and it doesn't make sense to wait this out. So I'm definitely reconsidering some of my longer term strategy based on this interview.
Well, let's get to the chart deck. Now, listeners, you'll find the download link for the post-game chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you have not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on the red button over Ole's picture that says looking for the downloads. Now, on page two here, Eric, I have that chart of the S&P 500, but let's start with your view on the equities here.
Well, to reiterate what I said last week, I doubt the final bottom is in yet, but I do think that there's a very good chance that we're seeing the beginning of a bear market rally that could last through year end. The setup was everybody fearing October might be the crash month. Well, October's over. The crash didn't happen, at least not yet. And now everyone's lifting their hedges. That short covering ignites the first leg of the rally. Then the upside momentum causes the trend followers to pile on. That takes it further. Now, Patrick, I'm curious to get your take on this because I would think a gamma flip would probably also be in the cards, and that would probably help the upside too. How do you see this market through year end?
Well, listen, we were in a pretty oversold state in October when that CPI number came out and the market dropped to a lower low and reversed. It really did, at this point in hindsight, for sure, solidify a short-term bottom. What we can, when that bottom in place, a typical retracement in the S&P 500 would have been towards 3,900 level, which has now actually been achieved. So yes, there are all sorts of things like the volatility is contracting, therefore vol targeting funds can be buying more. You have volatility contraction cause of VANA tailwind. You have certainly a neutralization of the gamma zones, all sorts of things that could then spur some buying as CTAs may certainly flip back to the long side of this market. But the one key thing for me remains, can we clear this 3,900 to 4,000 area? The way I look at it is if the market fails at this level and is given a reason to sell, it doesn't necessarily mean we have to go through another heavy sell cycle, but then it opens the window for a double bottom retests and all sorts of backfilling that may leave the stock market very sluggish into the elections. In order for us to have a bullish tone, I'd like to see the bulls actually demonstrate that all dips are being bought and then follow through some of these very key overhead hurdles. An S&P north of 4,000 gets it back into a high volume node congestion area, which basically would neutralize the prevailing downtrend and allow the bulls to even have just a fighting chance. So it'll be certainly something that's on my mind. On page three, though, we have that US dollar. And I want to comment on the trend here, but what's your take here?
Well, now it's finally starting to look like maybe a downside move or even a trend change in the Dixie could be afoot. But we've only seen one daily candle dipping below 110 so far. So let's wait and see what happens. Patrick, what's your take on the dollar chart? Do you think a top is in, or is it still too early to say?
Well, Eric, when we're talking that US dollar, it clearly has put in a short-term high. All sorts of trend lines have now started to be violated. It stopped making higher highs. We're in the midst of some mean reversion. The bigger question is this a big picture turn in the dollar, or is this just a very overbought dollar that was long overdue to do some backfilling? You know, this is probably the single biggest macro question to ask. I mean, this is where if, in fact, the dollar has turned, it certainly could drive risk assets because arguably the dollar strength has been what has been like a wet blanket dragging almost all asset prices down. And so if the dollar takes a break, it certainly can allow all these different assets to actually have at least a positive month. What one of the things we'll be seeing is whether or not the pattern of rallies being faded starts to emerge. There's always going to be these quick little bounces, but will the dollar be able to put together any really legitimate rally days, or are we going to now see that selling pattern emerge? A lot of that will come, obviously, from page four, where we have that Euro-USD. There's a prevailing downtrend that's been in place all year. It's a downwards channel that, for the first time, has been violated, and as beautiful as is that the violation of that descending channel has really all occurred at this parity level. And so I think technically it's really simple as to whether or not the euro can sustain above parity. Obviously, we got a 75 basis point hike and the market didn't initially overreact to it, but we'll certainly see whether or not the euro, you know, from its incredibly oversold state has room to revert. I could see a euro that's trading at 105 and just takes a break from the heavy selling. The bigger question after we do see this kind of reversion on both the dollar and the euro, will it result in a change of the prevailing big picture trend, or is it simply just one of those pauses that after a 1 or 2 month consolidation ends up just being a continuation of the trend to the upside? And that's certainly something that's going to be on my mind. Now on page five, I have crude oil. And I know you gave a pretty good summary at the beginning of the show, but one of the things I simply wanted to highlight was on the last announcement of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve release, crude oil started down and then reversed up off that news. And it really seems like at this moment, you can throw some sort of negative news toward crude oil, and it seems to be brushing it off. I'll be watching to see whether or not they can get crude oil north of 90, because that really, once again, would neutralize the sell cycle that's been dominant for over 4 months from June till September, and would certainly be the first moment in 4 or 5 months that we've seen crude oil potentially setting up for continuation higher. What is interesting, though, is on page six, is that energy stocks, in even the oil service stocks, which are even having a bigger run, and even refiners are doing so well. And it's interesting because the actual energy stocks are actually reflecting very bullish price action, even though crude oil and gasoline and other things have not yet really engaged in those bull trends. And the big question I'm asking, are these energy stocks basically advertising already the positioning everyone has, and that it's just a small formality for crude oil to join the party? Nonetheless, on page 7, I have gold. And what's your thinking on gold?
Well, Patrick, it seems to me like the excuse everybody's been using for the weakness in gold has been, hey, you know, it's just because of the strong dollar. You know, gold trades inversely to the dollar. Well, hang on, wait a minute. We've had the Dixie down almost 4 big handles in as many days. And to my eye, the gold at rally looks kind of muted here. I mean, it hit the 21-day moving average and kind of sputtered out. If you look at the equity rally, how it's come off of its bottoms, the S&P is way off of its bottoms. Gold's just barely making a little bit of a ding there. And even these last 4 days where the Dixie has been down every day, I don't see big green candles to match on the gold chart. So I'm still a little skeptical. I would like to hope that the bottom is in, but I'm really questioning whether it is. Patrick, what do you make of the gold chart?
You know, Eric, I hear you. It has been a very weak start. But whether a weak start or not, I still think that that intermarket relationship will stay true. If the dollar top is in, and if gold can clear $1,700 on the upside and silver clear $20 on the upside, then it will start to pop up on the radars of traders, and inevitably money flow will come into it. I'm a seller on the idea that if the dollar is going to be consolidating, that gold still sells another cycle. So yeah, it has been a very weak start initially, but I don't think that that changes my bigger outlook. On page 8, I just wanted to touch on copper. I know you started talking about it at the start of the post game, but really copper has, after that bloodbath in June into early July, has really just spent the last 4 months basing and creating consolidation and retesting those previous lows. If in fact Ole is right about conditions potentially changing in the coming months, it'd be really interesting to see whether this develops as a major bottom on copper prices. Nonetheless, the last chart I wanted to touch on was that 10-year yield. And one of the biggest things that's been a huge drag on equities has been the combination of a strong dollar being, you know, driving risk off, and the yields forcing multiples and dividend adjustments and all the different discounting things to reprice stocks lower. You know, we put in a short-term high as the speculation was there as to whether some operation twist of some sort could occur, and actually they defend the long bonds a little bit. And I think this is really critical to watch. It's been such an ugly go in this bond market that even if the bond market just calms down and mean reverts a little bit, and we see these yields back off, maybe that will be the further tailwind that the stock market needed.
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. The details are on the last pages of the slide deck, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, in this week's Research Roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as the slide deck that Ole provided, including this chart book that we just discussed here in the postgame. There's also a link to a number of articles that we found interesting. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. Does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.